Welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And don't touch that dial, because today we really have a special guest. He's been on with us before, but everybody loves him and everybody finds him interesting. It's N2COP, Bill Maureen. And let's see here. I'm looking at his QRZ page. It says, I'm very honored to serve as the vice director of the ARL's Roanoke Division. From 2010 to 2014, I was ARRL North Carolina section manager. Let's see here. Also served on ARRL's National Public Relations Committee for 12 years. And I'm the 2001 recipient of the ARRL's Philip J. McGann Award for Public Relations and the 2014 Roanoke Division Service Award winner. First licensed in 1970 as WN1NOP in Massachusetts, then became WD4NZF in Virginia and WB2ZHS in New Jersey before being assigned N2COP in 1981. Moved to North Carolina in 1991 and never looked back, he says. Maybe two in call, but I'm very much four in spirit. Active in Boy Scouts, served as a staff of station K2BSA at the 2001 and 2005 National Jamborees. Have helped over 2,000 Boy Scouts earn the Radio Merit Badge and have assisted over 300 youth to earn their licenses. 300 youth to earn their licenses. Graduate of Tufts University and the John Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Worked for AT&T International before moving to my present profession as a financial planner. His two sons, both Eagle Scouts and Hams, Reed, age 26, W4RSM. And let's see here. We also have Grant, and let's see here, his call sign, he's 25, W4GHM, and let's see here, I hold life membership in ARRL, QCWA, and Piedmont Chapter 126. He's also a member of FISTS, and boy, that kind of sums it up. But the reason why I'm telling you folks all this, and here is the reason why. Before we bring Bill on, you know, we have a lot of guests on QSO, but few have put the effort in to amateur radio that Bill has. And I mean as an evangelist of not just amateur radio, but also the American Radio Relay League. So it qualifies him, I think, in my mind, qualifies this gentleman to make statements that maybe other folks might not be qualified for. And I mean, we've got people in the league that are way up there that don't do what this man does, okay? Not anywhere, doesn't even scratch the surface. So we just want to say thank you to Bill Maureen for all the things that he's done for amateur radio as well as the ARRL. And I'm just going to shut my mouth and let's just get on with the show. With us today is Bill Maureen, N2COP. And we always love to talk to Bill because Bill is always into all kinds of things. So I don't know where to start with this guy. So first off, Bill, are you there?
I'm here, Ted.
I want you to give your introduction to yourself and then tell folks what you do. I mean, in terms of the amateur radio community and the American Radio Relay League.
All right. Well, first and foremost, thank you for inviting me back. I'd like to believe you and I always have great conversations when we get together. Call sign is N2COP. The first thing, Ted, is a lot of people go to, ooh, are you in law enforcement? Is that a vanity call? No, it's not. It was, it's original issue from 1981 when I was living in New Jersey. And I'll tell you a quick story, true story. About 10 years ago, I was home one evening and the telephone rang. At the other end of the line was somebody with a very decidedly strong New York accent. And he just kind of hemmed and hawed on the phone for a while and wasn't getting to the point. So finally, after about 5 to 10 minutes of pleasantries, I finally said to him, "Well, why did you call me tonight?" And he goes, "Well, let me get to the point. I like your call sign. I'm a New York City detective, and I want to know if you're getting tired of the hobby or you're terminally ill."
So what did you say?
It's
what
not would you... luck of the draw. I'll tell you a side benefit. I probably shouldn't because the curse may be broken on this. But ever since I've put the call sign on my car as a special amateur radio license plate, I've not had a speeding ticket. So I just let that one sit there, and I just I don't pretend I'm a cop. I never do, but I just let the call sign kind of go. But anyway, I've been licensed now for 45 years, and Ted, I think the hobby is better than it's ever been. There's so much to do. There's been an explosion of technologies, particularly in the digital side, that's just made this hobby better than ever, and I'm great. Now, you asked, what is it I do? I had kind of worked my way up the rung through the league. I started as a public information officer in the North Carolina section. That's my home. My home is in Wilmington, North Carolina, beautiful coastal community. And I went from the public information officer for 6 years, and in 2005, I was made the North Carolina PIC, Public Information Coordinator. That's the position within the ARL field organization that oversees, supervises PIOs in your section. And in 2010, I ran and was elected as the North Carolina Section Manager, and did that for 4 years until 2014. I decided to take a little bit of time off, so I took the summer of 2014 off, and in January of 2015, I was appointed to fill out the unexpired term of Dr. Jim Boner, N2ZZ, as Vice Director of the Roanoke Division, which means I was elected to the board of the ARRL. Dr. Jim moved up to director because the previous director, Dennis Botson, W4PWF, retired. And so now I'm in the board, and I represent four states now: North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and West Virginia. And so that's the brief history.
Well, that's interesting. Now, let me just ask this question though: isn't being a public relations director, I guess I want to say, of a section or the, as you call them, PIOs or whatever, does that not represent an awful lot of work if you are indeed doing the job?
Well, there's your point. Are you doing the job? If you're doing the job, it's, I wouldn't want to say it's a lot of work, because all these are people who do this, thankfully, are volunteers. I'd say those who are committed and passionate about telling the story of amateur radio don't look at it as work. But to be effective at your craft, yes, it does take a lot of time. But the reward is seeing some great coverage of amateur radio, both in the trade press and in the general press to the general public.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to QSO. We'll be right back with our guest, Bill Maureen, N2COP, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Let's talk just for a moment about QSL cards. And let me tell you about Mr. QSL, call sign K4JSG. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed. Now, if you go up on this guy's website, you're going to find this note that says, please note, these are custom designed cards. If you're looking for a plain, ordinary, simple, basic, or any other word that's a synonym for boring, you'll be better off with a different card maker. Now, somebody make a statement like that, that should tell you something. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed, K4JSG. Go to Google. Go to Google, put in Mr. QSL. That's Mr. QSL. The very first listing will be Mr. QSL or K4JSG.com. How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. Now, you be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the SkyWave from the Sea Crane Company. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website. Simply QSORadioShow.com. That's QSORadioShow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSORadioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. You're listening to the QSO Radio Show. It's all about ham radio. And now back to our guest, Bill Maureen, N2COP. Well, you know, I guess the thing is that the one thing I found dealing now with shortwave radio. When I was a kid, shortwave radio was something that people, I guess I want to say they relatively understood what it was.
Mm-hmm.
In their head, it was like static.
Yeah.
The sound of music in foreign languages and all kinds of things like that. It was the news coming in from different points on the globe and all that. Okay, now today you walk up to someone and you say shortwave radio and they give you a blank stare. With exception of the people who are really into it. And what's strange is that crowd is so divided. Like, for example, the Texan Radio Company in Beijing published an article that said that they made 30,000 shortwave radios per day. And I thought, that's got to be a misprint. So I checked it out, talked to them, and no, it's not a misprint.
Mm.
And one of the things that they said was is that our Radio Shack stores in the U.S., which right now are disappearing, but at that time stocked 4 or 5 models of their radios.
Mm-hmm.
Every store in the smallest stores, in the smallest markets, you know, where you have, you know, almost like a very, very small town or community that might have a Radio Shack store, they still had 4 or 5 shortwave models for
mm-hmm.
sale. And they promoted them. They had floor displays and everything under the sun, pictures of people with headphones on listening to, you know, the Eiffel Tower and the, you know, the Taj Mahal and all these, you know, listening. So, But I guess what I'm trying to correlate is this. When I get on the air on Saturday and Sunday nights, I'm playing music and we get a horrendous amount of emails. Oh, it's amazing. But still in all, if you went to your next door neighbor, knocked on his door and said, "What's shortwave radio?" You know, he's probably going to put his hands to his side and look up in the air and roll his eyes around and say, "I don't know." you know that's what's going to happen. So what I think we have a thing here, and that is that even though we have literally, I think we probably have several million listeners in the U.S. You know, I mean I'm talking about just to our station,
mm-hmm.
Not counting all the stations. I'm talking several million that listen to this thing because of the response we get. But
yeah,
they still in all, the general public is still an AM/FM crowd. They don't mm-hmm. really know this exists. These people are breaking out, though. They're saying, "Woo, tired of this AM/FM stuff. Tired of SiriusXM. Get me one of these shortwave radios. I want to hear all this stuff that's on here." And that's really cool, because when you do a music show on this station and you get 600 emails, 700 emails the first hour you're on, you know, it's overwhelming, because you think to yourself, a Chicago FM, 100,000 watt Chicago FM, I doubt could do that. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But one of the things about our shortwave listeners is they're a lot more responsive. They really are listening. It's mm-hmm. not on as much as a background thing as it is. They're really listening. Now, moving into the amateur radio arena, now that I've kind of painted that picture, I think that for us amateurs, ham radio is in worse condition that way. When you walk up to someone and say, "What is ham radio?" "I don't know. That's a thing with static on it." You know, I don't even think they draw that conclusion anymore, because when you say Voice of America, they go, "What?" You know, yeah, yep. Don't you know the BBC, the Voice of America? Haven't you ever, don't you know about, you know, Radio Havana, Cuba? No, never heard of anything like that, you know. So they're totally and completely, it's the you know, the iPod, you know, and what's left of FM radio. So when we say amateur radio, we're drawing a blank stare. So that in itself is enough to make the importance, or I guess I want to say to raise the level of importance to presenting amateur radio to the general public on a local level here in the USA. And I think that it's, I mean, I listened when we were doing, amateurs were doing field day. You were calling me, you were traveling all over the country, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm sure each one of those outlets was doing everything they could to get their local media involved in telling the story of this hobby. And so I tell that only because for folks that don't know, that is the reason why what Bill does is so important. Because it's going to take every one of those people in local communities to raise their hands and say, yes, I vote for these guys. Yes, they deserve to have these frequencies because they do good things with them. They do things on these frequencies that benefit us in our local community. And that isn't always emergency communications. It is sometimes, but other times.
And that's a great distinction, Ted. Let me start off with a humorous story of why we need PR. And this happened at the Shelby, North Carolina Ham Fest a year ago September, so September of 2013. That is the largest ham fest in the state of North Carolina. One of the draws that day was that visiting the ham fest was Miss Teenage North Carolina. Now, North Carolina is in the South, and for those who don't know, it's a very huge cultural thing in the South. For young women, are pageants. There's a pageant for every activity. I'm surprised you don't have the Miss TTW pageant at this point. We're graced at the Shelby Ham Fest with Miss Teenage North Carolina, who came in character and was a lovely young woman, very, very nice. But as the day went on and we got to have a little more of dialogue with her, she confessed that when her booking agency said, "You're going to the Shelby Ham Fest," she said, I was going to an agricultural pork sampling.
Or a hog killing.
Right, something like that. So, and this young lady was about 19 or 20. So, the point is that there is a tremendous gap. One of the things about PR is for those groups that are out there and are trying valiantly to get media to come out and cover their special event station on field day, we found that weekend reporters tend to be younger. They tend to be the less senior staff. Hence, because they're younger, they may not have been exposed to amateur radio. We've got the phenomenon now, Ted, that reporters who cover amateur radio events have grown up without landlines, and so their knowledge of really two-way radio is just cellular phone technology. They haven't gone through citizens band. They haven't gone through being forced to make calls through a landline. And correspondingly, the reliability of the cellular network has gotten much better, so that they're becoming more reliant on it. But what I mean is not the danger of that I'm talking about. I'm talking about that in their mind, monolithically, the only image they have of communication is a cell phone. So when you get a young reporter who comes to cover amateur radio, they don't have any background about what it is. And so there is a huge disconnect. And that has happened in the last 20 years. So public relations consists of trying to educate. It's a two-pronged approach, Ted. It's to, number one, educate the general public, as you would suspect, but number two, educating existing amateur radio operators to be more proactive in their outreach to the community to tell the general public about what amateur radio is about. And it's an ongoing mission.
You know, it's funny because when you get with young people today, if you show them a dial telephone, you know, they kind of like, huh? Something's wrong with this. Where's the buttons, you know? Right. If you show them a touch tone desk phone, some people kind of coil over that and go, you know, it's an oddity. You know, it's really an oddity, okay?
Yeah.
And now you go back and you relate to them that the cell phone they have in their hand is actually a two-way radio. And it's like they freak out. It's like, what? What do you mean? You know?
Right.
So
right.
The cell phone has become, which is, incidentally, a result of amateur radio. The cell phone came about because of amateur radio. You know, we can take credit for that.
But well, we can be, I'm not sure 100%, but we're definitely a component in its development. When you think about it, the repeater networks that became prevalent on 2-meter FM in the late 1960s, those repeaters are the predecessor to the cell towers of today.
Well, and, I can tell you, I heard the story told. I can't remember the particulars, but I can tell you the story that was told me, and I believe it was accurate. I wish I could remember the whole thing. That cell technology came definitely from a group of hams. The hams invented cellular technology, and we were the ones that actually came up with it. Now, I'll research that for the next QSO show, and I'll go into a dissertation about it, and then
good.
I will send
and
it.
Get back to me on that one, Ted.
I will.
All right, but here's regardless. But think about, let's go back again on the PR spectrum and how people knew about amateur radio. Amateur radio was initially viewed as not only a hobby, but was also viewed until about 20 years ago as a substitute for long-distance toll calls. And by meaning that is that people said, well, when you paid by the minute for long-distance telephone, and when telephone companies, cell companies began to move towards bundled billing, and particularly VoIP technology eliminated the need for per-minute billing. That was the beginning of the shift in the public's perception of amateur radio, because amateur radio was no longer a long-distance toll call substitute. And I think that was also the beginning where we began to see the decline in the use of VHF, UHF, FM repeaters too, because just like I can just call my buddy more quickly and try and track him down over the air. But also from a public relations standpoint, that's when, just as the public in the 1990s began to not see amateur radio as a long distance toll call substitute, we have the two back to back seminal events and tragedies of 9/11 in 2001 and Hurricane Katrina in 2005. And so the public's perception generally of amateur radio turned from a hobby and a long distance toll call substitute to emergency communications. And we, as a community as a whole, and ARL as an institution, rode that fairly well up until 2010, when the whole MCOM, short for emergency communications public perception thing, began to lose its R a little bit. And that R was lost because, and for the benefit of all, I might add, so this is a good thing, much of the cellular network became hardened and more reliable rather than still subject to spotty outages. And in 2013, I saw this chart, and I don't know the source. I forget, so I can't attribute it, unfortunately. But it was a study done by a National Engineering Trade Association about reliability of telephone service following a disaster, And in 2013, we had the crossover point in reliability between cellular phones and landline. And that was the point at which the copper pair no longer had supremacy in the two-way radio application of cellular phones. And that said that, and we saw this very much, Ted, with Hurricane Sandy, because in Hurricane Sandy, very generally, those cell towers, which were located in New Jersey and New York that were more than 1 mile from the coastline, had a very high success rate of remaining on the air, as opposed to those cell towers which were located immediately to the shoreline. And there was a time in which those cell towers would not have provided that level of reliability. So, again, we now in the amateur radio community are saying, well, we're facing with another paradigm shift in terms of public perception. So whereas up until the 1990s, we were looked at as a hobby and a long-distance toll call substitute, from the 90s until 2010, we were looked upon as the alternative for reliable emergency communications, and we still are. But in terms of getting the attention of the public, now we're looking in 2015, what is the aura that would draw somebody and attract somebody to become an amateur radio operator? I have some private thoughts on that, but I don't think they're necessarily consensus of the community overall.
Let me say this. I hear a little flaw here, and let me tell you why I say that. We're driving down the road, and we're getting a horrible snowstorm here in Tennessee, which people have no idea what this white stuff is. You know, they don't know. And all of a sudden, there's this weird material coming out of the sky. And everything was, I mean, just blanketed. It came on rather suddenly. And, I mean, it was like, you know, I'm going down I-40, going 2 miles an hour, okay? And I pick up my cell phone, and I said, oh, I need to call and let them know that I'm going to be a little late, which was obvious anyways. But I went to pick up the cell phone, and it was dead, okay? It was no signal, nothing. You could, you know, I held the thing up, and I dialed the number, and I hit send, and I waited, and I waited. And I waited and waited and waited and waited, okay? Nothing. And then maybe about, I would say after, I mean, seriously, about 10 minutes, this thing began to process the call. All right, and so it went into its thing, it dialed the phone number, and then it went into a rapid busy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So I said, this is useless. So I picked up, believe it or not, I picked up the microphone on my HF rig, and I popped in on some frequency. I don't know. I guess it was probably 20 meters. I don't know. May have been 40. And I talked to some guy 600 miles away and said, could you do me a favor? Could you make a phone call and tell so-and-so that I'm going to be late? Sure.
Cool.
You know, it was family. You know, see, he calls, you know, and then everything was cool. But that cell phone, I might as well have pitched it out the window. You know, it stayed that way for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and there was no crisis. There was no emergency. It was just a snowstorm. So I think, in my way of thinking, and of course nobody really cares about my way of thinking, and that's probably a good thing, I think that we maybe underplay the uselessness of these networks in the slightest little bump or bang. Now, I know when you said these cell towers that were a mile away from the coast did a marvelous job of staying up and all that, you know. But I'm wondering about how many failures there were similar to this. I mean, if I'm in Tennessee and we're surrounded, there's a cell tower everywhere. I think this week they put two in my backyard that I hadn't even noticed yet, you know. I mean, they just come up everywhere.
I'm getting royalties on those.
You know, but the thing is that I don't think we realize how vulnerable these things are.
Well, they are vulnerable, but all networks have been vulnerable. And believe me, I'm not apologizing for the occasional outage in the cellular industry. I'm very much pro-amateur radio. We're talking about public perception here, and the perception of losing coverage during a snowstorm in Tennessee, for most people, not you and I, Ted, because we're hams, but is that that's a one-off occurrence, and that the other 364 days a year, that cell phone gives a very high degree of reliability. So that they're sticking with that and trying to pitch to them and say, you know, it'd be great if for that one day out of 365 that you need an amateur radio in your vehicle is not a pitch that most people, I think, would resonate with. And that is a tough sell. We've got a couple of other tough sells. We're saddled with two very old-fashioned terms that have no relation to what it is that we truly do in the 21st century. The first is the term amateur radio. We know the reason why it's called amateur, because Part 97 says that unlike commercial broadcasters, we are not to be paid or compensated or receive any pecuniary interest in deriving income for our services. That makes sense, like an amateur athlete. But that usage has, in the English language, has changed in the last 100 years. So now we look at somebody who's amateur as not being very good at something. So that connotation hampers some of our public relations efforts. You know, and I know, that the noun in that expression, radio, means anything that's wireless. And radio is getting a more old-fashioned connotation to it. And then finally, just the term itself, ham. That's a lovely folk background as to why it's our nickname, but to many, they can't relate. Like the story I told earlier about the young lady who thought that a ham fest was a pork sampler. So we're stuck, and if anything, part of the PR challenge in the 21st century is to even look at our what we're called and improve the relevancy of our name. And I like to say that the correct term for who we are today is that we are federally licensed professional communications volunteers. It's a mouthful. It's my personal expression, nobody else's, but I think it conveys more accurately who we are and what we are today.
But you've got to come up with something with a maximum of two words, you know, in order
right.
to.
And I haven't coined that yet. I would love to make that a contest. It's too bad we can't accept money for pecuniary interest, because it'd be wonderful to give an incentive out there and maybe a box of Wheaties or something to somebody, just saying, come up with this great two-word expression that explains what it is and what we do.
Ted,
you were saying about where's the next frontier? Where do we get interest in the public? And I think we have an area that is very, very underutilized where we can get the next round of recruitments, and that is the educational movement known as STEM, S-T-E-M, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. This was a federal initiative that began in 2010 that has been promoted by the federal and many state departments of education. As you drive around, I think in many communities now, there's a STEM school, a STEM academy. There is the natural link between amateur radio and the future, that where all our wireless pioneers, the Lee DeForest, the Major Armstrongs, the Hiram Percy Maxims of yesteryear, they now can manifest their talents through amateur radio in a STEM environment. And that is an area where I think we can have a lot of potential.
Well, you know, I guess what I see is this. Where I think where we made a wrong turn down the road, okay, is becoming too official. And I've noticed this with ham radio for a pretty good while, and that is that we're just too official in a lot of ways. Now, emergency communications is really cool. I mean, and when you need it, amateur radio has worked miracles in places where, but it's very difficult to relate that to people who have not been in a crisis like that. They don't know what all that means. They hear it. They recognize it, but it doesn't really make a big impression because it's too nebulous, I guess I want to say, for them.
Well, it's nebulous. It increasingly is small. It's isolated. Even emergency communications has changed because where we see many amateur radio MCOM applications is in the first 6 hours after a crisis. And after that point, many of the commercial networks get reestablished, and amateur radio is no longer needed. So it's a short window of opportunity. When it does happen, it tends to be a very limited geographically area of opportunity, extremely crucial for that little period of time, but it's a flash in the pan compared to other things. And so, again, it tends to become lower and lower in the priority list of media, general media, to cover, saying where hams come in. Probably the greatest application of emergency communications this year so far has not been in the United States, but in Nepal with the earthquake. There's an area where they've only had, if I was just reading the other day, I don't think they had, either they had one repeater or no repeater, and a repeater was brought in to Kathmandu to help out with the tragedy. But in the United States, there's such a mature network, both landline and cellular, that the recovery time is very, very short. So that's very interesting, Ted, because the window of opportunity in a public relations sense to exploit amateur radio, and I use the word exploit meaning to make people aware of what makes amateur radio important, is a very short window. I know from having served on ARRL's public relations committee that when a public information officer for amateur radio gets a release out 3 days after an event in which amateur radio was the primary source of communications, that 72-hour lag in reporting that is insufficient. The opportunity came and went, and literally it's viewed as yesterday's news by news organizations. So PIOs get frustrated, but it's too late. And one of the key things, this is what I'm about to say, is very crucial for if you have listeners right now who are involved in the United States or actually really any place worldwide emergency communications, but the model I'm going to use is for the United States, that PIOs should know United States amateur radio PIOs should know two things at their fingertips. Number one, who is the section emergency coordinator in their area? And number two, what are the frequencies that are activated when an emergency is declared? Those two things alone, in keeping open communications, means that a timely release of information can get out, and your window of opportunity to get that level of exposure is much greater than letting the news go out 72 hours or 1 week later when it becomes stale and irrelevant and it's not going to get picked up by the news media.
Well, you know, I'm going to shift gears here on you just a little bit. Let me ask you a question. What is it that would cause you to go out and spend $300, $400, maybe $500, maybe $1,000, okay? Mm-hmm. What would motivate you to do that and also motivate you to break the law at the same time and doing both willingly to the point where you just couldn't wait to do it? Can you think of anything like that?
Well, no, I'm not quite following where you're going with this.
I know you're not, and I'm glad you're not, because it makes it even more dramatic, okay? Mm-hmm. In other words, here it is. You're going to go out and spend $500, and you're going to break the law, and you just can't stand it until you get it done, okay? Mm-hmm. This was the position many years ago when people were after fun and friends and fellowship over Citizens Band Radio.
Now, Ted, you wouldn't be implying that these said people were exceeding the 5-watt limit on Citizens Band, now would you?
Let me see. I think my DNA Phantom had 12 sweep tubes in it, okay? And I was, you know, so there were rules, okay? And here's what the rules were. The rules were as follows. Channel 1 through 8. You could speak to only your own licensed units, okay? So you were, say, KRM 492 or whatever the heck, the 4926 or 49, what was that? It was three letters and four numbers, because I remember guys used to make fun, and they would say, three letters and four numbers, you know. Anyways, so you had your call sign, channel 1 through 8 on Citizens Band. You could talk to only your own units. That meant your wife, your kid, whoever else had a radio in the car that belonged to your license. Okay, now, mm-hmm. channel 9 through 14. And at that time, 9 wasn't recognized as any sort of an emergency channel. It was just a channel. So 9 through 14, you could talk to anybody that had a call sign. All right? Mm-hmm. You had to observe. Well, let me finish the spectrum. And then from 15 to 22, you were back. Channel 15 through 22, you were back to only your own units. And then channel 23 was one you could talk to anyone on. Now, the whole thing was, is you if you talked for 5 minutes, then you had to observe 5 minutes of silence. And then you were permitted to talk another 5 minutes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Your antenna could not be, I think it was 20 feet over the top of the roof or wherever you were mounting the thing. And you had a limit of 5 watts into the final of your radio. Maximum, I think they actually designated like 4 watts out was the maximum, 5 watts in, 4 watts out. That's pretty efficient, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, but that those were the rules, okay? And it expressly said no chit chat. I don't know what that meant, you know, mm-hmm. because I mean, chit chat, what is chit chat? I mean, I think the commission should have defined what that was,
right.
you know, but nonetheless. People wanted to get on and talk. They thought it was so cool. They heard some guy across town talking on their friend's CB radio, and they heard the friendliness and the conversation and two or three people, and they're all a community locally, all talking back and forth. And, ah, man, I want to get one of those. I want to do that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun, but it was also a missing ingredient called fellowship. Now, all this online stuff that we've got going on, all right, texting, chat rooms, everything that goes with Facebook and all this stuff, all this social media, okay,
mm-hmm.
it's missing human element. There's a group out across the country, I think they call themselves Meetup, and in that city you can sign up for hiking, you can sign up for winemaking, you can sign up for people who like to cook. And these people get together once a month or however late they schedule it. It's a face-to-face thing. This organization, Meetup, is growing like a weed. I mean, it is coming on strong. And it blankets every city in the United States because I think people really want that fellowship and fun element.
Mm-hmm.
I think that could be the strongest selling point that we have for amateur radio.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember what it was like when I was a kid in the Citizens Band community. I lived in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. And, I mean, there were some incredible people on Citizens Band.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, but they were all varieties. I mean, it was all mixed up. I mean, you might have a guy on there that's a doctor. You may have some guy that you know, as a vagrant, running one of the 5-watt walkie-talkie. But they would stick together. Like, for example, if somebody met upon unfortunate circumstances, they'd have a party. They called it a coffee break. And these guys would all get together at some hall somewhere. They'd have a band. And the cigarette smoke was so thick. Of course, I was always around non-smokers, so I could hardly survive in the environment. My eyes were burning and everything. You know, but everybody had so much fun.
Yeah.
And I guess I look at that, and don't get me wrong, I'm talking to hams right now. I'm also talking to shortwave listeners that I say one of the things we need to do is radio amateurs, even though the term is not a real good one, we need to make it our business to make this a fun hobby.
You and I talked about this before the show began, and that is so true that some of the informality has gone away. I'm not anti-contesting. In fact, as time has gone on, I've had much more increased respect for contesters. I do think I'm not one. But these people really have the ultimate in operating skills. They truly are the master chefs of our hobby. But I think that level of contesting scares away more the casual ragtour. And we just need to be more open in amateur radio to the ragtours, who are the ones who really are the social people who want to engage in the social aspect of our hobby.
I think another thing, too, is a lot of hams forget the fact that they're being listened to. In other words, it isn't just the six guys that are on the frequency with you. It's thousands of people tuning in from all over the United States with shortwave receivers.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, some of the guys have got, I mean, they've got some pretty sophisticated shortwave receivers, and they're listening to the hams. And I think a lot of them are vicariously their hams.
You know? Oh, I think so. I started out as an SWL.
But I think we got to remember that. We got to keep we always have to keep that in our mind, that we don't know who's listening to us. And maybe we ought to go out of our way to entertain them a little bit, you know? I mean, and the same thing is with our fellow hams and the six guys that are in the group. You know, we need to make it fun. Some newbie comes on, you know, and we need to make it fun. Now, I don't know exactly how you achieve that, but I think a lot of it has to do with conversation. Like, for example, I've said this, if you get on the air and you get into you try to get into a group of guys and they just don't want you there, you know, they're just curmudgeons and they've been talking for the last 60 years on this frequency, man. And I mean, you don't cut it, you know.
This is my frequency.
Yeah, slide down the band, but you've got the same thing. Go to a small community where there's a barber shop and a bench outside.
Right, or a coffee shop.
Yeah, and drop in there and try to join in on that group, okay?
Right.
You know, so, I mean, it's the same thing, but you can always...
Let me make a couple of other observations, Ted, and that is, we're going to dovetail here a little bit. One of the things I hear very commonly as an ARRL official is that, and by the way, for those of you just tuning in, this is Bill Maureen, N2COP, Vice Director of the Roanoke Division with ARL. I'm talking with Ted Randall, host of the QSO show. Wait a minute, did I just do a reversal? I'm sorry, Ted.
Oh, boy, here we go.
No, one of the things I want to say is, as an ARL official, one of my common complaints I hear, and particularly from older hams, is that where are the young hams? Where are the young people today? And some of these older guys get pretty strident with me. They go, you know, we have our meeting every Tuesday night at 7:30 at Slides Barbecue, and these kids aren't coming out, and they're not picking up the good parts of the hobby. Well, there's a wonderful book that I recommend to a lot of people. It's got an unusual title. It's called Bowling Alone. It's by a guy named Robert Putnam, who's a Harvard professor, And it talks about the decline of traditional social institutions since the end of World War II. He focuses on mainly fraternal organizations, Rotary, Kiwanis, mainline churches, to say that those or many of those organizations have had declining attendance and declining new participants because younger people are have other outlets and forms. And that's the key thing. They have other outlets and forms. I know of plenty of young hams, and they should be the pride of our hobby. But they also have other responsibilities. They are trying to juggle full schedules. Most of them are very academically talented, which means that they're carrying pretty heavy course loads. They do a lot from their house. A lot of them are doing digital. There's an appeal there, which means you don't hear them on the air in terms of their voices, but they're doing things like PSK 31 and Olivia, and they don't have transportation maybe to get out to a meeting at night. So there are plenty of young people out there who are hams, but the traditional format that appeals to older hams, meaning a physical meeting, a physical presence of getting together, is not necessarily appealing to younger people. Doesn't mean they're not committed to the hobby. It's their rate and how they participate is different. And we as amateur radio operators, particularly older established ones, need to adjust to that. I didn't say compensate. I think we just have to recognize that the traditional format is of having Saturday morning breakfast someplace or a mid-week night meeting is, in eyes, it may be not appealing. If it is appealing, it may be inconvenient for these people. I know a 16-year-old ham who plays a young man, a very successful ham, by the way, but he plays the three sports through the school year. He plays football in the fall, basketball in the winter, and he does track in the spring. He had been doing baseball. He switched over to track. And his schedule is such that he really doesn't have the time to participate in traditional ham meetings. Now, I've run across hams in his town who, again, give me that song and dance. There aren't any young hams anymore. And I point out, well, do you know about this kid? And they go, well, yeah, we've seen him, but we don't know much what he's doing. I said, do you know that he carries a full course load? He's participating in three sports, and he's also worked 189 countries, but he tries to do the best he can to juggle his schedule. And just because he's not coming up to the ham meetings doesn't mean that he's not engaged. And that's something that the seasoned practitioners of our hobby need to understand.
Well, let me say this. I'm going to add another aspect to this, okay? The thing you were saying, you said, what would draw a young ham out to a meeting? Well, another young ham, okay?
Yes.
Or two or three young hams, maybe four or five young hams, okay? That will draw young people out to the meetings. Now, you got to understand something, though, and that is, in a lot of cases, one young ham, one lone guy shows up at a meeting, okay, and there's all these old guys sitting around a table, and you know, they kind of get beat up on. In other words, it's kind of like I'm looking down my nose. Are you one of those no code generals?
Yeah.
You see, no, we don't accommodate young people.
We don't. That's a serious flaw in our hobby.
I listened to a guy here in town in our fair city. There was a bunch of fellas that were hams that were operating on a 440 machine. I don't know which one it was. Anyhow, a bunch of blind guys, but blind hams at the blind school are on talking on 440. And right away, we got this curmudgeon comes on and says, the National Weather Service is listening to this frequency, and they really don't want to hear all your conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, let the National Weather Service turn the radio off because there's not a cloud in the sky. And the guy over there is a ham anyways. I mean, he's a ham. And it's far better to have these blind kids talking on this machine than to have the machine totally unoccupied. It just didn't make any sense to me.
And
you know, so I see things like that, and it really bothers me. But now let me just say one more thing here, and that is that young people are looking for other young people, and they're also looking to the older community for a little wisdom and guidance. You know, I mean, and not a look down your nose kind of wisdom and guidance type thing. You know. And I see the problem being in reverse. I see the problem not that there's not young people in ham radio and that the young people don't attend meetings. I see it as that the old people don't make the meetings, I guess I want to say, compatible. And they don't take an interest in a young person that actually shows up. Okay, now I know you're wanting to say something here, and I'm going to shut up right now.
there's a couple of sins that hams commit, older hams. Not all, but I've been to plenty of meetings, as you have, and we see some characteristics that tend to emerge there among the majority. And you're right. Here's another one too. Let's say you do get a young ham in, and he comes to one meeting, and he is treated cordially, but the next month, and he's invited back, so everything worked out well. The next month, he doesn't come back. But the reason he doesn't come back is that he doesn't want to come back. He doesn't come back because he may have a big test the next day for which he needs to study. He may have a very legitimate reason. So he shows up 2 months later, and suddenly, he's under attack by all the other hams. Well, where were you last month? We thought we treated you really nicely at that first meeting. Why did you stay away? Well, he's a kid. He's got other things going on in his life. And rather than gang up on him, the hams should just kind of let kids, they've got to be flexible in today's environment. There's just too much demand. This is another societal thing on the side, but in terms of ham radio, kids have too many obligations for fulfillment that they need to do. And by fulfillment, I don't mean for self-satisfaction. I mean just to make it these days in terms of studies, athletics, extracurricular activities, college prep, and oh yeah, I have a hobby on the side, amateur radio. Older people many times don't accommodate that, and also regrettably don't assign a lot of credibility when you have a young ham who has been successfully operating from their home QTH. I'm thinking particularly about those who do digital, and can come in with a big brag sheet of what it is they're doing. And the older people just look at that and go, but you didn't check into the local net, and you weren't at the meeting last month. You're not a really good ham. That's discouraging. That really bothers me when I see that lack of understanding that older hams say, if you don't conform to our model, then you can't be a real ham. And that is something that's going to have to change if local clubs want to begin to have younger members come in.
Well, I can relate one thing, and that is I have two sons. And at one point, they were much younger, just like I was and you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we made an attempt to go to our local amateur radio club. We joined and became members, and field day came around, and they were out in the middle of their field or whatever, and the antennas that went up in the air by these guys were some of the most pitiful things that we had seen. So the boys wanted to, they had their slingshots and everything, and they were wanting to pull dipoles up into trees, and they brought all kinds of gear with them and all that. And so the only thing we needed to do was just to coordinate, you know, the frequencies and say, okay, mm-hmm. what band can we operate and all that. And so I think the first year we tried this, we were looked down upon And you could tell they did not want to accept these young guys, but these they were pulling, they had like double extended zeps up, and they were pulling all kinds of stuff up into the trees, different some phase directional things that they had put together. I mean, these are young kids putting this stuff together, you know. And the bulk of the crowd, I watched this, the bulk of the crowd just kind of was irritated by it all. And they let you know they were irritated. Okay, yeah. So we ignored it and just kept on, said, you know, we're here a little while, eventually we'll be accepted. Well, next year came along, and all of a sudden the kids were barred from doing any of this. Okay, yeah. And I thought, okay, we're leaving. We'll leave these old guys with their Coca-Cola bottles with a conduit purchased on top, you know, perked on top of that, and they can run their two-bit verticals and all that stuff that they're running and make very few contacts, but they've got control of it. Indeed, that's what they wanted. They wanted control. Okay, so we just kind of stepped away, and I had a situation here where my younger son got on the local repeater and was talking to another friend of his, and this guy jumps in and says, we would like to reserve the repeater for out-of-town people.
Oh, geez.
So I jumped in and I said, hey, I'm originally from Detroit. Do I qualify? Of course, you know, that was taken entirely too seriously by the guy that made the original comment. So we just started working simplex in town, you know. And actually got admonished about using a certain simplex frequency that we had chose to
use. Oh, I've had that happen, too.
Yeah. So there was like, you're getting shot at from three different, you know. So now we have this big, huge shortwave station, you know. And I had one of the fellas there said, boy, it would sure be cool if we could come out and look at the. I said, hey, listen, why don't you schedule your next meeting out here at the shortwave and come out and look at this big 100 kilowatt shortwave station, these big rhombic antennas and all that, you know. And so we went to one of the meetings, and we got there a little late because we had an engineering thing doing. We had to get there. We got there late and went in to talk to the guys, and it was like you talk about being snubbed, you know. And anyways, we just decided, guess what, you know, we're oil and water. You know, now the other thing. Okay, now you got two young men. One is chief engineer at Tribeca Nazarene University, takes care of all their HD video, everything that goes on over there. I mean, I went over to look at his system. I'll have to send you a picture of it, all these TriCasters and all this stuff that he's working with, all this video. And they've got radio stations on campus that he takes care of, all the transmitters and stuff. And then you got Matt, that's David, KG4, WXW, and then we have my younger son, Matt, who is KG4WXV, who's the chief engineer for the Dave Ramsey Show. And he takes care of 500 radio stations, you know. So at one point in time, the local repeater, which had decent coverage until they moved it so it only covered, you know, like a third of the area. And then it went down. It was down for a considerable period of time. So we raised our hands and said, hey, you know, we take care of broadcast stations, so why don't you, you know, let us go out there and put this thing back on the air, because it doesn't seem like anybody has any time, you know. As soon as we suggested that, it was like we had set off an alarm, you know.
Right.
Nobody's allowed to go near this repeater except us that really, we know electronics because we have a ham license, you know.
Well, you know, I guess I see all of that. And then to me, I think, and I repeat it, not to be negative at all, but I think that kind of paints a picture when it comes to attracting young people into the hobby.
Well, here's the other thing. 20, 30 years ago, young people would put up with that because one of the few outlets for creativity in electronics was amateur radio. Now, they can either do it by themselves without the support of other local hams if they want, or they can move to a strictly internet environment without a ham license and do it may not be wireless, but do type of social media type work. And so basically, we got young people don't need us. And that is the lesson that older hams need to do. Now, can I switch gears on you, Ted?
No, I'm in control of this radio show, and I've been at ham radio for 85 years, young man.
Because this is I'm going to use the treatment of youth, amateur radio youth, as a backdoor. I'd like to use it as a backdoor for discussion about the current bill that's in Congress, H.R. 1301, the Amateur Radio Parity Act of 2015. May I do that?
Sure.
All right. So, in my hometown of Wilmington, North Carolina, we had a young man, 12 years old, earn his technician ticket. He was very excited, very supportive of amateur radio, became very active locally on various repeaters, became active in Skywarn, became active in Aries in our local market, and was very mature for his age of 12. His parents were not hams. He lived in a townhouse in a development with a homeowners association, an HOA, and he put up a 4-foot-tall, 2-meter J-pole encased in a white PVC shell and attached that to the back of his deck. In and of itself, just a what looks like a PVC pole just resting off the back or attached to the side mount, a balustrade on the porch behind his house. One day, a member of his neighborhood's architectural committee was walking the area behind townhouses, saw this, and asked him, "What is it?" And the boy replied very innocently, "That is an amateur radio antenna. I'm an amateur radio operator." The architectural board member said, "That 4-foot-tall J-pole is out of compliance. It is against the covenants of this neighborhood. You must take it down." That one act took that boy off the air, and he's never been on the air again. Now, that begs a discussion of what, why are we not seeing more people on the air? And I've got a very interesting statistic to share with you. I want to qualify this. The statistic applies only to the state of North Carolina, where I was, which I currently represent as the vice director for the Roanoke division, and I'm the former section manager. But I think the number I'm about to give you is representative nationally, at least I think east of the Mississippi. West of the Mississippi, it may not apply as much, except in California and Arizona. But here's the statistic. In North Carolina, 38% of residents live in housing that is outside of an HOA, or homeowners association, meaning 38% live in housing which is regulated only by municipal ordinances, meaning county, city, town, or village. 62% of residents in North Carolina live in housing that's within an HOA, homeowners association, and those homeowners associations have CC&Rs, covenants, codes, and restrictions, many of which, or actually most of which, have antenna restrictions. So, we've got a very favorably here in North Carolina. In 2007, North Carolina passed an antenna law that hams can erect an antenna up to 90 feet tall in an area with reasonable accommodation, meaning that a local municipality cannot prohibit a amateur radio operator from putting up an antenna to get on the air if they live in an area that is regulated only by municipal ordinances. And that state law applies to the 38%. It does not apply to the 62%. The story I just told you about the 12-year-old who had to take down his 4-foot-tall, 2-meter J-pole encased in PVC, he's part of the 62% in North Carolina. The bill before Congress right now, where they're seeking co-sponsors, H.R. 1301, would address the 62% in North Carolina, and we, I think, comfortably, but I don't have the actual absolute data, probably over half the licensed hams in the United States live in neighborhoods with covenants, codes, and restrictions. And H.R. 1301 would allow a amateur radio antenna exemption similar to the exemption that satellite TV dishes such as DirecTV and Dish TV have, so that if you live in a neighborhood like that with an antenna restriction, you're still permitted to put up a satellite dish in order to get satellite television reception. The 1301 would allow amateur radio operators to operate within HOA. So of all the initiatives in 2015 that are most important to ARL, I think really to all hams in the United States, H.R. 1301 is one that needs to get more co-sponsors so that it can be voted on in, and hopefully made law. If not this session of Congress, in a session of Congress very soon.
You know, I guess I can see the, how do I want to say it, the close-minded fanaticism. And this is, you know, the thing of it is about our country, and that is we seem to rally around the rights of, minorities. I mean, you know, if you belong to a particular religion and you have to, leave your desk in the middle of the day and put ping pong balls on your head, you know, or do something just as strange, these people have a right to do it, and they do it, and they're protected. Okay, so to me, it seems like something as useful as amateur radio, when you're putting up an antenna that's so innocent in terms of, is it an eyesore? No. Okay, does it cause any problems? Is it a lightning attractor? No. Okay, so there's nothing legitimate that somebody can come up with other than, I don't want to look at that. You know, that's the whole thing, and I don't understand it. You know, so. If I don't understand it, well, then it can't be. So I think that everybody ought to get it. So what can people do to get behind this H.R. 1301 and let whomever know that we're adamant about this? We want to see this. We're a minority, and we want to be protected because our rights are being violated, you know, as, I don't know. I mean, how can you become active with this?
Well, okay, so here's the way, and we can discuss all the different arguments. The person that you need to contact, if you're listening to this and you live in the United States of America, is your representative in the United States House of Representatives, colloquially known as your congressman or your congresswoman. And there's a very easy way to do that. You just go to a search engine on your computer, you just type in who is my congressman, ? And back will come the website for your congressman along with a hyperlink to an email. And all you simply have to say, you don't have to be very elaborate, just say, would you please consider co-sponsoring H.R. 1301, the Amateur Radio Parity Act of 2015, and just put your name and your address, which authenticates that you are a voting constituent in that congressman's district. That's all you have to do.
Well, you know, take someone that's retired, and they're living in one of these restricted areas, you know, and, you know, having a small amateur radio antenna, and I say small, but even having a moderate amateur radio antenna could make a huge difference in this person's life and their quality of life.
Absolutely. Now, I've heard arguments from other hams that said, well, you shouldn't have moved in there in the first place. Well, what if your interest in amateur radio develops after you move in and you get licensed after you move in? What if you have extenuating circumstances that your spouse is not a ham, but your spouse moves into a HOA neighborhood that has accommodations for older people that have mobility problems, which a conventional non-HOA housing in that area may not? thereby sparing you the cost of renovation. There's a lot of arguments. You can't put a blanket all saying, well, heck, you shouldn't have moved there in the first place if you wanted to operate as a ham. That's not going to wash. And then we have some very powerful adversaries, Ted. Your listeners need to know this is not a slam dunk. We have several homeowner national trade associations fighting H.R. 1301 and telling their congressmen not to support this measure. We have to put together a powerful representation and persuasion that we are a community resource. The one that is true from some past hurricanes through which I went through in my home state of North Carolina were neighborhoods that were just cut off after a hurricane, and these were neighborhoods that had one ingress and egress, in other words, just one avenue in and out, and a tree had fallen across, and there were people in the neighborhood with medical necessities and no communications, diabetics, broken legs, and here we have this tree blocking any kind of services or being able to come in or allowing residents to go out. That's when you want to have a ham radio operator in the neighborhood, somebody who has the training and the equipment to get the message out. We have somebody here who's in diabetic shock. We have somebody here who has had a snake bite. We have somebody here whose leg has been broken by a tree which fell on them following a hurricane. That is where, and if that's a neighborhood that has an HOA with antenna restrictions, you want to have a ham. And the other thing is, which really, this really ticks me off, Ted. This is probably the angriest I'm going to get during today's broadcast. I hate it when an HOA says, well, you can't put up antennas under normal conditions, but if there's an emergency, we'll waive the restriction. That is just a bunch of malarkey, because the reason that makes amateur radio successful is ongoing practice, knowing which repeaters to go into, knowing to test your equipment, knowing that you can check in, knowing where to go, when to go, at what frequency, in what sequence. Remember the old joke, Ted? If you're a musician, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Remember that?
No, I don't, but tell us the answer.
Yeah, the answer is, if you're a musician, you get to Carnegie Hall, how do you get there? It's practice, practice, practice. How do you be a successful ham radio operator, Ted?
There you
practice,
go, practice.
Practice, practice. So don't let an HOA bamboozle you into saying you can get on the air after emergency. Things happen. Frequencies change. Check-in protocols change. Unless you hook up your equipment, you don't want to have dead batteries. You don't want to have a broken coax connector. Don't want to know that your antennas aren't working. After the disaster is not the time for the first time to get on the air. It is ongoing participation, which makes for the successful ham radio operator. So, all right, enough of my soapbox on that.
I guess the thing of it is that if a person has a choice, and they're getting ready to relocate, they need to go into a place and find out whether or not there's restrictions for putting up ham antennas. And if there is, okay, then they need to turn to whoever it is, not that is managing the place, but the ownership or the board of that association, and say, I choose not to live here. And incidentally, should there be an earthquake or something, this place will be totally vulnerable because there'll be nobody wanting to help you out. And let them know right off the bat. You know, I guess I'd tell other people too. I'd say I wouldn't live in a place like that. Those people.
Well, now,
and I
now think, let me just say, mm-hmm. just because the restriction is in there, I know of actually quite a few hams who negotiated a waiver on the antenna restriction before they purchased the property. And so they had the covenant legally amended so that they can have an amateur radio station. That's actually a very successful strategy, more so than, and it doesn't get publicized much, but the time to do that is before you purchase property in a complex. And just say it's a deal breaker if I don't get this amendment or this waiver.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, there's a certain amount, and once again, we go back to the same thing we started on, and that is these people have no idea what you're talking about. I mean, they're thinking that all of a sudden, I've got this mad scientist moving in here that's going to put a 90-foot pole in the back, and he's probably going to be trying to animate dead bodies in the basement, you know. They don't know. They have absolutely no concept of what amateur is.
Well, the nice thing is, I'm going to put a plug in for ARRL here. There are some wonderful brochures available through ARRL, which explains to the general public what it is that we do in emergencies and how we serve communities. So they're really great full-color slicks that depict amateur radio helping out with local parades, helping out after earthquakes, wildfires, hurricanes, ice storms, blizzards, and they're great talking pieces when you meet with officials at an HOA or government officials as to explaining what is amateur radio and how it can benefit a local community.
Well, you know, I guess it's weird because I had the occasion where I had to live in an apartment complex for a short period of time taking care of a group of stations. Radio stations, and so I went to the apartment complex owner, I guess it was. They were owned by a company of some kind, and I said, I want to run a wire out of the back of this thing, and I want to go through here, and I wanted to pass through this area here, and it was open wire feeder is what it was. And then there was a fellow that had a big vacant lot in back of the complex, so I went over and I talked to him. I said, I want to stretch a wire between this tree and this tree and attach it to this thing here that's going back. And you know what? They applauded the move. They were 100% on the money with me, and they didn't question it. Matter of fact, everybody kind of had an interest in it. You know, they were kind of like, oh, that's kind of cool. What are you doing? You know, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, so it was really kind of a door opener for me. You know,
right.
But I've heard
right.
other people talk about the unreasonableness and the close-mindedness. And it's mm-hmm. like once you get one of those guys on a warpath, mm-hmm. you know, he feels for some reason that the amateur operator is the devil, you know, and we need... You know, we need to control him. So when you run into those kind of things, it's, you know, I don't know. That's the part that's discouraging. It really is. But like you said, if you start off at the beginning of this thing and attempt to negotiate your way through it, then I think you're a whole lot better off, especially if you can show some benefit to that, that community. If you can show them benefit, then they're going to be open to you, you know.
Right.
But there are those impossible situations where you really need legislation to protect the ham radio operator from unreasonable prohibition. You know, it's like, you know, I can understand if somebody put up an old rusty 90-foot tower in the backyard and then started running guy lines everywhere, and you know, and the thing looked like it was going to fall over. You know,
I could
understand people saying, you know, that's an eyesore. But yet, how many pictures have you seen of some ham shack with a tower and a big Yagi up on the top of it, you know, 20 meters or something, you know, five element, 20 meter, 17 meter beam, and a picture shot of that right at sunset? You know, I mean, mm-hmm. Does that not just give you goosebumps?
Well, it gives me goosebumps. I'm not sure it does the general public. But in fairness, I know of a ham here in southeastern North Carolina who went into one of these planned developments, and he did succeed in getting a waiver that he could have a ham station. Once he did work very carefully with the committee in putting up a tower, and it's it is a Yagi, but I will tell you, it did a magnificent job. It is landscaped beautifully. It's about as unobtrusive as a 40-foot tower can get in somebody's backyard. Very nicely done. He maintains it. And, oh, I want to add, too, he's the top performer in the local DX Association.
Well, that's really cool. Now, so get a hold of your congressman and this H.R. 1301. Just remember, everybody says that 13 is an unlucky number, and this is we're talking about one bill. So it's 1301. That's how you can remember it, H.R. Ham Radio 1301. And get a hold of your congressperson and just tell him, hey, look,
The best way, Ted, is a simple email. Go to the congressman's website, find where it says contact here. Just a very short note. Please support H.R. 1301, the Amateur Radio Parity Act of 2015. Sign your name documenting that you are a voting constituent, and just send it. That's all you have to do.
I'm going to steer you in a different direction here, if I can.
All right, I have yet another topic to steer you in another direction, but I'll let you go first.
Oh,
it's your show.
Me. Anyways, for folks that don't know you, okay, and I know you've been on before and all that, but folks that are just tuned in and they're saying, "Who is this guy?" Okay, you know, and I'll go ahead and repeat what you said, and that is, this is Bill Maureen I'm talking to, N2COP. And 45 years, did you say you've been in ham radio?
45 years. I got licensed in 1970.
All right. I want you to tell me, or tell the audience, what was the first time you ever even heard there was such a thing as ham radio?
Oh, that's a great story. It was 1963, so you can see it took a good 7 years for me to go get my ticket. I lived in a small town in Massachusetts, small, not in population. Actually, it had 54,000 people, but it was geographically small, very condensed. It was 5 miles by 3 miles, and there was no school buses except for the special needs students. So if you were physically able, you walked everywhere. And I walked home from elementary school with a boy about, I think he's 3 or 4 years older than I am. And his house was on the way before my house, so I'd walk home with him. And one day he said, "Hey, I'm going to talk to my dad. He's a merchant marine man, and he's out at sea." And I looked at him. I said, "Well, how the heck are you going to talk with him? He's out in the middle of the ocean." He goes, "By ham radio." And I go, "What's ham radio?" He said, "Well, you know, why don't you, I've got a station in my attic. Why don't you come up and take a look?" And I think back now, he was on a postage stamp lot. All the houses in my hometown were in postage stamp lots. And, looking back, he had some kind of wire configuration, but he had a regular skid with his dad on 20 meters. And they chit-chatted back and forth. It was actually a very efficient way to handle family business communications. Sometimes his mother would come in. She was not licensed, but he'd get on. My friend was a general at that time. So she'd get on a third-party thing, and they'd go over family business and get stuff done. They'd have a good chat for about 20 minutes and then sign off. And I came away from that saying, "Wow, is that not cool?" And that's where I got the bug. That was 1963.
Okay, so then what happened? This all just kind of simmered until 1970?
It all simmered. I had vicarious outlets. I did the CB thing. I did broadcast radio. For those who remember, I got my third class radio telephone license with broadcast endorsement, Element 9. And it wasn't until the summer between my freshman and sophomore year of college that I got serious and took a novice class. And this is kind of an interesting story. I grew up in a suburb of Boston, and the novice class was being taught at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They had a six-week class leading up to your novice ticket, and so I successfully got my ticket. So I tell people, Ted, that yes, I am an MIT grad.
Well, let me ask you a question. While you're in Boston, did you ever listen to Larry Glick?
Oh, yeah, I was a Glicknick, sure, WBZ, 10:30 a.m., clear channel, 50,000 watts.
So you were actually a Glicknick.
Yeah, remember, if you were listening, you were a Glicknick.
Well, did you ever have a popular, was it Popular Communications? No, it was, anyways, did you ever have a WPE number?
No, did not have a WPE number.
Okay, I just wondered. I always ask people that. Let's see. So that was the deal. So what was your first ham rig? What was the very first thing? The first thing I had,
my receiver was a Hammerlin HQ110C. The C meant you had a clock built in. And I had my transmitter was a Nightkit T60.
Oh, boy.
And I had like five crystals.
Now, did you build it from kit or did you get it?
No, I got it. It was already assembled. I got it used from another ham.
Wow. Yeah, see, now, I love these stories. These, you know, I mean, this is the kind of stuff. That, and you know what? The thing of it was, though, is you were CW, you were crystal controlled, but I bet you couldn't wait until you were able to get in the shack and get on the air. And I bet
absolutely.
You probably...
And I think I told you earlier, too, that I couldn't afford a transmit-receive relay switch, so I used an open knife switch between the 450 ohm ladder line. And when you went from one to the other, you threw the knife switch. And then the other thing is the tales of yesteryear. Remember, you were collecting wallpaper and you were looking for states, and there'd be some guy who was two kilohertz, or in those days, two kilocycles up from you, and you heard him. You go, "Oh, I need that guy." After you looked up in the call book, but you were crystal bound if you were a novice, as I was at that point. And so you could take the cover off the crystal, and if you lightly sanded it, it might be, you could move up a few KC. And so I did that a couple of times, and inevitably my ham was far too heavy because I would end up sanding enough off to move up like totally overshoot it and move up like 5 to 6 KC. And, you know, I missed the guy. And I got a new frequency I didn't have before.
I will say this, and that was there was a certain joy, though, in being rockbound when you were transmitting on one frequency and all of a sudden you hear someone calling you, you know, several KCs away because they were rock bound too. It was just a procedure. I mean, you just you sent CQ, or you would sit there and call the guy who was calling CQ, you know, up always. I don't know. I guess I want to say I missed that. When you said wallpaper, what folks don't know is he's talking about QSL cards.
Oh yeah,
you know, were they
and certificates? You know, I have my rag chew certificate. You know, after signed by the old sock himself.
Well, you know, this is the stuff. I think you know that this is the one of the elements that's missing. See, and I don't see that technology, social media, and all this stuff with the computers. I don't really see that there's competition between these two types of modes. This is a completely different world than...
Yeah, but you know, Ted, without getting overly nostalgic, that was a lot of fun back then. But remember, it took you 2 months after you took your FCC exam to wait for your license to come in. Today, licensees get them within sometimes two business days. And I think that's better. I've fallen in love with LOTW, Logbook of the World. It's yes, it is instant gratification. I will tell you, my postage bill's gone down dramatically. That is that's really nice. So again, there are aspects of our hobby that have gotten much, much better. And I think those are two examples, VE testing and LOTW, that I'll tell you what I do miss. It is fun getting a QSL card in the mail. It still is. You know, the other day I was thinking the parallel would be kids today who wait for college admissions. It used to be that in our era that you waited for if you got a thin letter, you hadn't been accepted to an institution. But if you got a manila envelope that was pretty thick, you had gotten in. Well, now the kids just sit in front of the computer, hover, and wait to push the keyboard button for enter to see what their decision is. The drama is still there, but I kind of like the old version of the thin envelope versus the thick envelope, and I still enjoy getting QSL cards in the mail.
Let me tell you something, and this is true. When you're running or involved in a large shortwave station, and you get 600, 700 emails in or something like that, it's very, very impressive. I mean, it's just incredible. You can't answer them all. But let me tell you something. When we go to the mailbox and we pick up a dozen, two dozen envelopes, And it's got that foreign postage on it.
Ooh, the foreign postage, right. You know,
and it's got the name, the guy's name is written out, and he's got all the curly Q's because they write better than we do.
Yes.
And you open that envelope up, and a lot of these people send a couple bucks, you know, in the mail to make sure that you're going to not cheap out on them and not send the QSL. They want that QSL
card. They do.
Card.
They do. And that's still the fun part of the hobby.
And I'll tell you something. When you get those envelopes in your hand,
mm-hmm.
there's a certain amount of magic that no email can duplicate, period. Okay?
Right.
And so right. I don't know. I don't want to say it's old school. I think that's the improper way of looking at it. I think what it amounts to is just persevering and doing the work. You know, saying, okay,
well,
I really want
these
cards.
Different method these days. It's still more satisfying, but it's. But I don't want to be overly nostalgic. I think LOTW has done a wonderful job of really allowing people to get more awards more quickly in a very legitimate format. I think that's healthy. Now, can I switch gears once again? This is your show, can I hijack it for a second?
How much money you got?
Well, you know I don't have much, and I'm an amateur. I'm not allowed under Part 97 to bribe you. But
oh,
I do have great information for you and for all your listeners.
Go ahead, Bill. You are I'll tell you what, you're a prized guest on this show.
Well, I've got a resource for a lot of people. I've got two underutilized resources that I want to let people know. These are little hidden gems that are on ARL's website that a lot of people may not know about. And one of them I think is a particularly good gem. One is, depending on your information, let's go first of all for getting back into the PR realm. If you go, and it's not well advertised, you got to dig pretty deeply in the ARL website to get this, but if you go to the search engine in the upper right corner on the main page of ARL at ARL.org, type in Media Hits, H-I-T-S. It's also, you can drill down if you go in at the bottom of the page under PR and Media Relations and just keep hitting, get down. You get some Media Hits. There are stories in the general press of amateur radio sorted out by state. So, if you live in Arizona and you're curious what in the last 30 days has there been about amateur radio in Arizona, you can find it. Or in your case, Tennessee. Or in my case, North Carolina. It's a great little tool. It's a great tool for section managers putting together a monthly section newsletter. It's great for PIOs. It's great for just people who want to say, hey, what's going on in my neck of the woods that they want to know about? So that's a little hidden gem that's there. Now, here's the other hidden gem, and this is a great one. Starting this past January, which means now it's only about 5 months old, ARRL began to post a video library. A lot of people don't realize that for many, many years, ARRL has had a lending library, an actual library, particularly for clubs, when clubs need to put on a program that you could have the league send you a DVD on a program, and all the club had to do was pay for shipping one way, the cost to ship the DVD to return. And in return, you got a professionally produced 30 to 40 minute program about an aspect of amateur radio. That's always been there. It's still there, as a matter of fact, the lending library. What's different now is that it's gone electronic. So at no cost, no shipping cost now, you can go to the ARL website and type in the word library. It will come up as one of the selections of the library. And it's the there's now several dozen PowerPoint presentations or videos sorted by subject matter, all of which are designed for club meetings.
That's incredible. That's a real cool thing.
It's a very cool thing, very underutilized. Hasn't been promoted much so far. But at last count, I think there were, Oh, I think there were 36 PowerPoint presentations available for clubs.
You know, I want to say...
And by the way, I don't think you have to be an ARL member to get them.
Really?
I'm not positive on that one. I probably should have done my homework on that. But I think they're universally available.
Let me say this. If a person is wanting to make a contribution to the hobby...
Mm-hmm.
You want to see the hobby get better. You want to see, you want to preserve what we've got. Okay. And you want to improve on it and make it better. If you're not a league member, you need to join. Now, before people draw a conclusion and say, oh, wait a minute now, you know. No. I'm not saying this from the perspective of the league is right about everything. The league does no wrong. The league is perfect in all aspects. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that they are an organization that you can get involved in, and you can get involved in the ARRL, and you can set the pace. You can be the one to make the suggestions. You're the one that could make objections. You could help form the path and help build this hobby. We need numbers. We need people.
Well, we do. Now let me get back to this library thing. Again, not promoted enough. It needs to get promoted. These PowerPoints and videos have not been produced in-house at ARL. They've been produced by hams outside. They are reviewed by ARRL's Public Relations Committee. What I mean by reviewed is that those committee members who are other volunteers are taking maybe, I don't know how often, you know, maybe in groups of five or something, they're looking at these and they're just critiquing them to make sure that they're accurate, that they're, and maybe offer back to the creator some production techniques or some suggested verbiage change. But basically 99% of these PowerPoint presentations and videos are produced by outsiders. And they're now up on the website and they're available for clubs to download. But my point is, if you have a specialty and you would like to submit one for consideration as a club presentation, again, under the when you put in the search engine at ARRL for the library, the club library, the life, I wish I remembered the name. I don't have a computer in front of me. There are guidelines there, about three pages of guidelines saying, hey, would you like to submit a PowerPoint or a video for consideration to be placed in our club library? Here are the things that we'd kind of like to see, so that we can make it available for anyone who wants it. And the difference is between that and one you see on another search engine is that I'm not saying the quality's better. It's been made into a club-friendly format. Now, there's lots of videos and PowerPoints out there that are already club-friendly. I don't want to say there's a monopoly, but if you're there and you're saying, yipes, I need something that's been vetted to be accurate and is in a club-friendly format, and I haven't got time to review everything out that's on the Internet, go right to the ARL website, and it will tell you exactly how long it is, at what level it's appropriate, you know, beginner, advanced, and you just go, oh, here's one we can use at the club meeting next Tuesday night. Click, boom, downloaded, and suddenly you're the hero as program director for your local club.
You know, I want to get back up on my soapbox. Is that all right with you? Can I get back on the soapbox? Or just
absolutely. Crawl back on.
Okay. The whole deal is this, though, and that is, let's just look at the benefits of the league. Let's look at it totally from a selfish standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to get out of this, okay?
So, mm-hmm.
You can go online. I think this is the most fantastic thing that I think I've ever, you know, upstairs in my attic. Well, it's not really the attic. It's the spare bedroom. We've got like two or three bookcases full of QSTs. I mean, just jam full of them, okay? I see them at Hamfest. The guys have boxes of them, and they're giving them away because the wife says, look, you got to get some of this stuff out of here. So they don't want to part with a DX100, so they're going to give away the magazines. you know, and some of them that are priceless are the old 73s, if you can find those.
Oh, yeah.
You know? But now here is the deal. You can go online, and Bill, correct me, how far back does the archive library of QST go? In other words, you could go in there and type in the search engine. I remember at some point somebody had a project in there called the Tuna 2. You know, all right. So you can type in Tuna 2. Bam, that edition pops up, and you can go through the whole thing, the diagram, the text. You can actually print it out, you know, and sit it on your desk and go build you a Tuna 2 if you want to.
Right.
But how far back do these archives go? I mean, I remember at one point in time, somebody told me.
Once again, Ted Rando with Stump the ARRL official. There are various aspects of QST that are available, I believe, continuously back to its first publication in 1915. I'm not saying that every single article has been archived yet. Mm-hmm. I think what you're saying is, in terms of most articles, I think they go back to, I'm guessing now, I think about 1980, and then you have most content from 1915 to 1980, but I'm not sure.
One of the most interesting things to do is to go into the ARRL QST archive.
Yes.
And look up the year you were born.
Yes.
That'll blow your mind.
It will blow your mind.
You know, but in other words, this is something that's so invaluable. How can you put a value on this? How can you say this is worth this?
Well, first of all, look, I want to be, I think nothing's worse than somebody ramrodding somebody else. Am I a league official? Yes, I'm a league official by being a vice director. I would like to believe that somebody who joins ARL for $39 a year gets tremendous value in return. The subscription to QST alone, I would like to believe, is worth it. But there are so many hidden resources available that if you are an active ham, or you want to be an active ham, or you want to be more proficient in the hobby, that $39 is not a lot of money. It's probably three or four meals out of Denny's. If you could substitute three to four meals out of Denny's, eat at home, you've paid for your annual subscription to be an ARL member.
Or one meal in a lot of restaurants.
Or one meal in a lot, yes. I mean, is it a lot of money in its own right? Absolutely, yes. And I know that that hams are frugal. Notice I didn't say cheap. I said they're frugal.
I say cheap.
And frugality is good. But I do think you get more for your money than I think a lot of people realize through league membership.
You cannot go into a bookstore. Books a Million. What's another one? Give me another one.
Barnes & Noble.
You can't go into those places and go to the magazine section and get a magazine on amateur radio. It's not there. It used to be you could get CQ. I don't know. They've dropped everything. I guess we don't exist anymore. But here's, and I'm wondering sometimes when I look at all the crazy magazines that are there, there's got to be more radio amateurs, out there than there is some of the subject material that these magazines are printed on. I don't get that. But nonetheless, I'm not a publisher. I'm not going there. The whole thing is, though, is there's nowhere to get these things. You have to, I tell hams, if you've got a license, you should be an ARRL member just for that alone, to get the magazine, to be able to look those archives up, to be able to get all the other things that can come to you in email that you may sign up for. And then also to be able to be a part of an organization that represents you and your hobby, to Washington, D.C. and all those folks. I mean, it's all...
And internationally, too.
How about a shortwave radio you can hold in the palm of your hand? How about a shortwave radio that's no bigger than a pack of cigarettes? And yet, so sensitive and so selective, it will blow your mind. I'm talking about the SkyWave. The SkyWave radio from Sea Crane. You need to go to the Sea Crane website, seacrane.com, and check out the SkyWave. I've not seen anything like this radio. I've looked at every kind of shortwave radio there is. This thing is a mind blow. It really is. It's based around some sort of a DSP chip, I guess I want to say. And, buddy, when it locks into a signal, it locks in. I'm listening to WTWW on this thing, and I'm just having my mind blown. Go check this thing out. If you don't have one, you need one. If you're a shortwave radio listener and a shortwave fan, you have to have a SkyWave, especially with Art Bell coming back to radio via shortwave on WTWW. Now, if you'll call the Sea Crane Company and order a SkyWave mentioning WTWW, you get a special bonus. Now, you be sure and do that. Check out this little radio, the SkyWave from the Sea Crane Company. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Let's talk just for a moment about QSL cards. And let me tell you about Mr. QSL, call sign K4JSG. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed. Now, if you go up on this guy's website, you're going to find this note that says, please note, these are custom designed cards. If you're looking for a plain, ordinary, simple, basic, or any other word that's a synonym for boring, you'll be better off with a different card maker. Now, somebody make a statement like that, that should tell you something. The world's finest QSL cards ever, guaranteed, K4JSG. Go to Google, put in Mr. QSL. That's Mr. QSL. The very first listing will be Mr. QSL or K4JSG.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN, TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at the QSL Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. That's all the time we've got for QSO this week. Thank you for listening. And thanks to our guest, N2COP, Bill Maureen. Tune in again next week, same time, same station. And that's on 9475, 1 p.m. on Saturday, Central Daylight Time, 7 o'clock in the evening on Saturday on 5085. Thanks for listening to QSO and 73.